They called her the Belle of Amherst. But what were the mysteries behind Emily Dickinson's life of seclusion?
Her dog died.
Her second cousin died of typhus.
She took up baking.
For 135 years, one mystery has confounded everyone. How did Hope lose its feathers?
Her high school principal died.
Her mother was cold.
She wrote a lot of poems you can sing to the tune of Yellow Rose of Texas.
Now, one documentary unlocks the mystery. That was the third time I said mystery. That was the fourth.
She was a mystery.
There were more mysteries than anyone knew.
If you look up mystery in the dictionary, there's a picture of Emily Dickinson.
That's not literally true. This holiday season, from the producers who brought you Salinger, comes the tale of tangled sexuality, tragedy, betrayal, and totally mysterious mysteries. You didn't stop for death. Now it kindly stops for you. Dickinson in 3D, not yet rated. And now the secret 14-year-old mistress of Dr. Seuss, Colin McEnroe.
That's not literally true either. Or is it? All right, so we're talking today about Salinger, and we apologize for that introduction, but we're going to play you the trailer a little bit later, and not too much later, to this actual documentary, Salinger, which is being released on Friday. There's a book connected to the documentary, which is out today. We thought for all those reasons, we really ought to spend a little bit of time on Salinger. We're going to sort of merge Salinger and Thomas Pynchon, or Pynchon, as I'm informed you're supposed to say. But either way, he has a book coming out later this fall. They are, of course, neck and neck as America's two most celebrated American literary genius recluses. They're both extraordinarily fond of junk TV, too. I don't know what the connection would be there. But we're going to spend some time today just talking about the mystique of Salinger, and we'll go from there into Pynchon, too. I can't use the saying Pynchon, though. I don't think I could do that. We're going to talk a little bit about the documentary, and then just kind of about the hold that Salinger has on so many of us, the way in which we feel spoken directly to by Salinger. And I think that's sort of the difference between Salinger and Pynchon. Pynchon really, you know, kind of invented postmodern American fiction, and he certainly is the godfather of Jonathan Franzen and David Foster Wallace and a whole bunch of people who came along after that. But he doesn't really feel like he's talking right to you, whereas obviously Holden Caulfield, everybody has that experience reading Catcher in the Rye, of thinking this book was written specifically for them. Millions and millions and millions of adolescents read that book and think, oh, so this book has been written specifically for me. Some people, of course, take that idea so completely to heart that they use it as an excuse to go and shoot somebody, which in fact is one of the many things dealt with in this documentary. So it turns out that over the weekend, the documentary was shown at the Telluride Film Festival. And so we are lucky enough to have with us Sasha Stone. Sasha Stone is editor of awardsdaily.com. She was at the screening. We should say, in a moment that seems more out of a Thomas Pynchon novel than a J.D. Salinger novel, prior to the screening, a group of executives from the film company connected with the screening landed in Colorado, and their landing gear collapsed, and they had a crash landing. Everybody escaped unscathed and unharmed. But it just seemed like, you know, could you have one more ominous, weird, portentous thing connected to this whole event? But it is more Pynchon than Salinger. Anyway, Sasha Stone, you were there for the screening. First question, was this a screening that everybody knew was going to happen? Or I almost get the feeling reading some of the accounts that it was a little bit of a last-minute thing or a surprise.
It was. They had actually scheduled Philomena to play, starring Judi Dench, and somehow that got derailed, and Salinger was in its place. People were kind of suspecting that it might show up because it's the Weinstein Company, and Telluride is the best place to launch an Oscar contender. And so when it turned out that the surprise movie was going to be Salinger, everybody, you know, was so excited, although many people leave on Monday on the last day. But I happened to stay and see it at 9 a.m. at the Palm.
And you've already written about it, but give us your overall sense of it. I don't know how much time you had to prepare for this, considering that it was a last-minute announcement, but how did it hit you overall?
Well, I, you know, being a kind of a Salinger fan anyway, I had already sort of combed through Wikipedia about his life, and, you know, I was curious about the women and, you know, what made him a recluse and was he really a recluse? And I think that the movie is a lot like that funny intro that you played. I mean, it's very salacious. It's very, you know, people could say it's exploitative, but it's also revealing. I mean, a lot about Salinger I didn't know. I didn't know that he had started writing Catcher in the Rye during World War II. And he saw so many things and experienced so much trauma, he had a nervous breakdown. And he didn't finish Catcher in the Rye until much, much later. But, you know, the filmmaker, the director of the film said that the war made the man, but it broke the writer. I mean, I'm sorry, that's backwards. It made the writer, but it broke the man.
Yeah, so you have this sense of the PTSD. There was no word for that in the time from 41 to 51 when he was A, fighting in the war, and B, writing this incredible novel. And then I gather, and obviously it's hard for there to be new news about Salinger, although there is some in this movie. But you know, one of the things it explores that's not necessarily virgin territory, you should pardon the expression, is his fascination with these very young women. That, you know, his second wife was I think 18 or 19 when he met her. Joyce Maynard, 19 when he met her. This much younger girl, Miss Miller, was I think 14 when he met her, and although they did not consummate the relationship until she was 19. Does the movie sort of get at that in any way? Does it speculate as to why that would be the case?
Absolutely. In fact, I think when people see it, that's going to be the takeaway. The two sort of traumatic takeaways from the film are going to be, why did Catcher in the Rye inspire so many people to commit murder, and why was Salinger so obsessed with young girls? And what kind of damage did that do to those women? And another weird thing that happened at the screening was that Joyce Maynard appeared. She wasn't in the Q&A. Gene Miller was. But Joyce Maynard was there, and this was her first viewing of the film, and she had, like, you know, tears coming down her face, and she had talked in the lobby to some journalists about how she felt that the movie kept referring to the girls as women, and she said that was her only problem with it, is that they were actually girls. And she was the only one who really confronted Salinger about how he sort of shut her out of his life when she started to get a little bit older. But, you know, she was definitely traumatized by him. She said that it's been, you know, every day of her life since she met him, she's thought of him, and it's affected her life personally and professionally. So
and
I think that, you know, how Woody Allen is sort of defined by this, and this is going to be Salinger, part of his legacy, you know.
Absolutely. That parallel had occurred to me as well. So I know less about, because conventional biographies of Salinger, or the Paul Alexander or the Ian Hamilton book about trying to write a biography of Salinger, they don't go in so much to the Mark David Chapman and other killers or shooters who seem to have somehow or other been inspired by Catcher in the Rye. It's just sort of not normal terrain for a biographer. So I know less about that, less about what even these guys say about it. I can see from the trailer they have a clip of Mark David Chapman actually talking about it. So in a nutshell, without wrecking the movie for anybody, I mean, what did you get out of all this?
Well, first I should just say at the top that there are a lot of you know, photos and video footage of Salinger that have never been seen before. And they make several announcements about his future published works that no one knows about. So just on that alone, people should see the movie to see the, you know, there's only one photo of Salinger writing Catcher in the Rye, and that's during World War II. And you got to see that. I mean, it's wonderful. They show Mark David Chapman explaining why he killed John Lennon and referring specifically to Catcher in the Rye in his own words, and how he read from the book at his trial, you know. So, but they also, you know, apparently two other, so who else was it? It was Mark David Chapman and John Hinckley, who had read Catcher in the Rye. And then there was the guy who stabbed, you know, that young actress. I can't remember her name, but they also found Catcher in the Rye in his apartment. But, you know, that's sort of in my opinion, a dubious connection, because, yes, they found the book in his apartment, but that doesn't necessarily mean it inspired him to, it's Rebecca Schaefer, to stab Rebecca Schaefer, you know. So, but the movie doesn't tell the other side of that story, which is that you can't really make the direct connection between art and murder, I don't think. But they definitely leave it hanging as, you know, the book, you know, it people connected with it, and loners especially, people who felt rejected by society. I imagine that a lot of the school shooters now, if they read Catcher in the Rye, they identify with it. It just so happens that that was, you know, a prior generation probably.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is everybody connects with Catcher in the Rye. So it's not too surprising that this particular subset connects. In other words, generationally, in terms of, as you're, not even just loners, but any kind of disturbed adolescent, which is pretty much all adolescents, find this kinship with Holden Caulfield. So in some ways, it may be just a function of the book's incredible pervasiveness and incredible popularity, particularly among people who have not sort of completed the transition into adulthood. That just could be one reason it just turns up over and over. Listen, Sasha Stone, great to talk to you. People should read more from you, including your review, awardsdaily.com. Thanks so much for joining us again on short notice from Telluride. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Thanks.
As we go along here, some of you are going to want to talk about Salinger yourselves. Our number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We'd be happy to talk to you either about, to me, one of the big questions, and I think it is something that people will want to talk about as we go along here, seems to me one of the real collisions that happens again and again with Salinger, and it's happening again with this documentary and the 700-page book that accompanies it, is the collision between legitimate literary inquiry and this particular person's profound need for privacy. And it happens, as I say, again and again with Salinger. He's a titanic literary figure, so people want to know more about him. And probably also, because he doesn't want people to know more about him, didn't want people to know more about him during his lifetime, that, of course, makes people want to know even more about you. But even so, let's forget even that he was like that. There would be just, you know, as there is with any gigantic literary or artistic figure, you know, a desire to know a lot more. And then you've got it smashing against his woundedness and his need for privacy. And so you may have thoughts about that, you know, which should win the day. I think we know which is winning the day anyway. 860-275-7266 is our number. We're going to get into it now with Will Hochman. A little bit later, Donald Brown, a Pynchon scholar with the New Haven Review, will join us. But we're going to start with William Hochman. He is he's a Salinger scholar. He did his dissertation on Salinger in 1994, been reading Salinger since he was 10. He is the co-author of Critical Companion to J.D. Salinger, a literary reference to his life and work. He's joining us now by phone. Will Hochman, I know you haven't seen the movie yet, but I think you've gotten your hands on the book that accompanies it, right?
Well, no, actually it's being delivered today, but I can tell you I've tried to stay on top of every J.D. Salinger report that's come out via Google alerts. So I've done everything but read the book and see the movie.
All right. Well, let's jump ahead in the conversation to the pig in the python, and that is, you know, you just heard Sasha Stone say, well, there's sort of two big bombshells in the movie. One of them, the whole question of Salinger and young women, young girls. The other one, the whole question of murderers who are attracted to his book. But there's another bombshell in the book, and that is in the movie, which is the suggestion that there is more Salinger to come. He hasn't published since 1965. Suddenly, we're hearing via this documentary that there are as many as 5 works that will be released, that there's even a predetermined schedule for their release. So as a Salinger scholar, process this for us.
Sure. I'm happy to be here and help if I can. There's really a great wealth of Salinger material that scholars have followed. So everything I've read about the book and movie, there aren't as many big reveals as may sound, but there's certainly some interesting information, and I'm really grateful for that. It's the books that will come out, I believe, will make me a happy old man because I'll have new Salinger books to read for a long time. But more importantly, Salinger stopped publishing for very good reasons and was misunderstood as a recluse. First of all, I don't know what the rules to being a recluse are, and I don't believe he's ever declared that he is a recluse. But he is an artist, and he's been developing Caulfield families and Glass families since he began as a writer, and some of the stories, for example, the last and best of the Peter Pans was a name bandied about as a Holden Caulfield collection of stories. Actually, that's a story in which Vincent Caulfield talks to the mother in the family, and it's really a great story. So there are already unpublished Salinger stories that, in my opinion, rank with some of his best early work. And I think that he's been a master craftsman who's needed to write to survive. You know, it's an extreme form of being an artist, but in his case, I think we can understand why he's doing what he's doing. He's writing great literature, and the fact that these books are coming out posthumously, and I have to admit, I don't know what they're going to be. If it's more of Hapworth 16, 1924, which was a long, rambling story that many people disliked, then there may not be great Salinger stuff. But I'm really hoping there is, and I've read enough of his letters to other people to believe that he all along he's been open about the work he's been doing, the collections he's been making. So it's no surprise to me that we're going to be reading some posthumous Salinger.
Yeah, you know, let's go back to that whole idea. One, you know, and this probably will get your hackles up. It'll be a number of questions I'll have for you today, Will Hochman. It'll get your hackles up a little bit. But, you know, one argument that's been made about sort of Salinger's kind of post-Franny and Zooey work, or even post, you know, Catcher in the Rye / Nine Stories work, is that that and particularly, you know, you're talking about the Hapworth story. Paul Alexander in his biography talks about how that was scheduled to be published at one point by this strange little publishing house that was run by one person, and it was they were gonna follow Salinger's rules, which inevitably are about sort of no interesting cover art, no promotion, no nothing, none of the things that you typically do to sell a book. Can you do? You can just publish the book, and that people who want the book will come and find it and get it, and all this kind of stuff. And that was called off. And in his biography, Paul Alexander makes the case that maybe it was called off because Machiko Kakutani, the equally reclusive and lynx-like critic for the New York Times, just wrote this essay ripping Salinger to shreds and seeing that his later work just wasn't that good, you know, that it was so based on its own self, so much a product of this kind of claustrophobic thinking that he'd begun to engage in, that it no longer engaged readers successfully, and that Salinger maybe backed away just because he didn't want to deal with that kind of critical reception to his work. Even Franny wasn't all that well-reviewed, I think, as you just suggested. So what about that? What about the possibility that, A, the work isn't that good, or, B, that he wouldn't publish it because he was worried that it wasn't that good?
Well, I have to admit, I've probably written the only positive review of Hapworth 16, 1924 in a small magazine called Moonbeam that's out of print. But my take on his later work is that he's developing a deep understanding of the Glass family. And, you know, Hapworth 16, 1924 gave us a lot of books to read that, And I believe as a scholar to try and read what Salinger has read. And so, you know, I've read too much on Vedanta Hinduism for anybody's good. But
you haven't started drinking your own urine, though, hopefully.
No. Although, I can say that there's a method to his madness. And he's developing a family. And, you know, if you think about it, his Glass family started with Seymour Glass's suicide in A Perfect Day for Banana Fish and has been growing backwards. So by the time we get to Hapworth 16, 1924, we're listening to seven-year-old Seymour sound like a college professor. And I think that is outlandish. So, you know, I can say that maybe he has gone off the deep end, and maybe there are just more Hapworth 16, 1924s, and maybe only scholars like me will be interested. But as I said before, I think there's enough evidence in his previous work and unpublished and uncollected work to indicate that he's a master craftsman, and he's had plans for books. That's been known since Margaret Salinger published her book. And I think Joyce Maynard was an eyewitness to the vault of manuscripts. And everything he said about his working habits and his desire to create the Glass family and perfect it makes me believe that we're in for some of the best Salinger yet. Keep in mind that Catcher in the Rye was one of his major achievements as a novelist, but he was also known as a master short story writer. And I would contend that that's equally important when we talk about Salinger. So you decide, Colin, are a few unknown, really good Salinger stories worth reading through, a lot of stuff?
Oh, of course. And for me, of course. I think, of course. You can't look at this as other than a great opportunity. And the worst that's going to happen is you won't like them that much, but you get to read them and find out. And I think all of us, except perhaps J.D. Salinger, wanted that to happen. Anybody who's remotely interested in his work. Hey, let me just quickly go back to the movie for a second. Now, this movie, in some of the ways that Sasha Stone suggested, it seems a little bit on the lurid and sensational side. And Sasha Stone said that the promo, the Emily Dickinson promo we ran as our introduction, was kind of like the movie. Well, we're going to just play you a little bit of the actual trailer to the real movie. Okay, this one is not us goofing around. This is the end of the real trailer of the movie, just so people get a sense.
He wanted nothing to come between him and his characters. They were real for him. He moved them about the stage like God.
You cannot dismiss the issues of his private life.
People heard him, people he trusted.
He said, "You have ruined my life."
I saw two manuscripts.
What's in that vault? Someone cracks that code, man, it's going to be the story of the century.
Writing a book is a horrible, exhausting struggle. One would never undertake such a thing if one were not driven by some demon. And he had demons.
That's the real trailer. That's the real music for the trailer. So you get the tone anyway. Now, I mean, it could be that the artists who made this documentary have a higher vision than that, and they got talked into that by the marketing department. But, Will Hockman, and by the way, if people want to call in and talk in any way about J.D. Salinger, 860-275-7266. Let me say that more slowly. 860-275-7266. This movie, we do know, goes a lot of peculiar places, places where a typical Salinger scholar probably wouldn't be all that interested in going. I mean, including, bizarrely enough, the notion that somehow or other the primal wound or one of the primal wounds driving J.D. Salinger to write these explorations of human pain and disconnectedness was an undescended testicle, or the fact that he only had one testicle, or, I mean, I don't even know which one it is that they're saying, or whether there's a significant difference even. But, I mean, as a Salinger scholar, I'm assuming this is just somewhere you're not interested in going.
Oh, absolutely. What I can say about his testicles are he had the ability to survive Utah Beach. He had the ability to fight in every major land war in Europe. He had the ability to survive Hurtgen Forest, the most deadly battle in Europe. He had the ability to free a death camp and survive those images. That seems so much larger to me than his genitalia. And the truth of it is, I don't know that it can be confirmed by a few people who make that assertion. I guess a doctor's report would do it for me, but I'm not sure it has much relevance. We talk about someone having testicles or balls, and the metaphor for that seems to me much more important than the actual reality.
That's a great answer. Our number, 860-275-7266. I think the other thing is, Salinger wrote a lot about woundedness from war, and certainly, for Esme with Love and Squalor, we see PTSD, even though there's no such name. We see a soldier with it, vividly drawn for us, too. But he didn't really write about war that much. He wasn't Norman Mailer or something. What he did write about is human interactions and human connections and human failure to connect. And to that end, I'm wondering how you feel about the exploration that is apparently conducted extensively in this movie and has been attempted elsewhere, just about his relationships with women. There is something a little strange about all this, the idea that he bonded so many times with very, very young women and had these relationships that were kind of quasi-sexual rather than fully sexual, it seemed. But You know, I mean, how fair, you know, people who write fiction, they hate it when you look at their lives. Even if their lives aren't weird, they hate it because they're concerned that you'll subtract from your notion of their inventiveness and say, oh, no, he's just or she's just returning, you know, actual things from his or her life. Here, I don't know, is it worth it to look at this part of Salinger seriously?
Well, I think you have to look at it, but I want to quote a line from my favorite poet, Richard Hugo. He said, "I've done things bad as any German," and Hugo was a World War II hero as well. And so I want to say that, first of all, Salinger's first wife was his exact age. Yes, he was involved with a number of young girls, not always sexually.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often, C.C. Smith and a few others have revealed letters that Salinger was interested in who they were as people and not sexually. So I have to say I've looked at the Joyce Maynard case very closely, and I respect her wounds, so to speak. But I can also tell you that she's profited as an author greatly from Salinger, even selling his letters. And that you know, when we talk about these things, you know, Phoebe Caulfield is a great character in literature. She's 6 years old. Or you take Esme, who is just old enough to possibly be a young girl of attraction. And I know that someone in the movie is claiming that the story Esme is based on her, which I doubt. I think she's more likely to be the example of Sybil from A Perfect Day for Banana Fish because she knew Salinger in Florida. But the truth of it is Salinger is ambiguous, even in Esme, about possible sexuality, although I doubt it's there. And yes, the man had attractions, wives, and differences with a number of females, not the least of which his own daughter. He in a letter he once told E. Michael Mitchell about Matthew giving him another grandson, and this always kills me. And then he said, "And Margaret too has bread." So, you know, he did have, I think he did have a very sexist view of the world, quite possibly. But in those days, most people did.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a little break here. We'll come back with more of Will Hockman. We're going to come back also with Donald Brown, who's a Pynchon scholar, not uninterested in Salinger as well. We're going to talk a little bit about reclusiveness with both of our guests, but also about perfection. The sense we have, I think, that Salinger's work as it exists right now is kind of perfect.
I like your book, Catching the Rye. J.D. Salinger, you are an interesting guy. You were like, I can't take this anymore. I'm just gonna go hide in a little town in New Hampshire with some lady.
All right, we're talking about J.D. Salinger. We're going to add to the conversation in a few minutes Thomas Pynchon as well, or Pynchon, as apparently we're supposed to call him. We'd love for this to be an interactive conversation with you. So if you've got your own Salinger memories, or as we get into the Pynchon section, Pynchon memories, 860-275-7266, or your axe to grind, either with the author or with the people who invade the space of the author, 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. With us right now is Will Hockman. He is a Salinger scholar, co-author of Critical Companion to J.D. Salinger, a literary reference to his life and work. You know, one of the things that it's interesting to think about is why we're having this conversation, why inevitably we will have conversations about J.D. Salinger that are kind of unlike our conversations about any other American writer. There really isn't anybody else who's allure, whose mystique is quite as universal, quite as enduring. And I wonder if one part of it is this sense that it's the existing work is kind of perfect. And especially, I think, Catcher in the Rye. I don't think anybody would change a comma in Catcher in the Rye. You know, it is it took 10 years to write, and it is, as what it is, a thing of perfection. And I feel as though the nine stories, too, are as fine a collection of nine stories by one American writer of short stories as there could possibly be. They're just right. They're just perfect. And they're just a beautiful dispersal, too, of topics and subjects and tropes. And I suppose one argument against releasing five more Salinger works is they might not be that perfect. What do you think about that?
Well, a few things. First of all, I want to say I really don't believe he's written a manual on Vedanta Hinduism. Most of his exchanges with his Swami in the Vivekananda Center were thank you notes for the $500 that he gave them every year. There's no evidence that he was writing a book on Vedanta. So I'm not sure what's out there. But I want to tell you something. I did some research this summer at the Morgan Library, and I found so much gold in letters that he wrote to E. Michael Mitchell that other people have read and said, well, there's not much there. And I'm going to explain something in Salinger. I'm going to paraphrase Salinger explaining his writing and his attitude towards friends to his best friend. And E. Michael Mitchell meant the most to him as a friend. They were only friends together for a short time, but they were artists together very deeply. And he said to E. Michael Mitchell, I don't know really that the kind of life I live is tellable in any normal ways that friends tell each other other things are going. For the last 20 years or more, against very peculiar odds, despite quite a variety of interruptions and intrusions, a lot of them unnecessary and even malefic, I've been exploring things, looking into things with my writing, my fiction. What the result of it ultimately will be, I can't say, and I'm not sure that it's any of my business. The attractive assignment or task alone is what I've wanted. I've seen results before, and they interest me not at all. What I'm mainly trying to say, though, is that I felt unable to afford the marvelous distraction of first-class friendship, especially the kind you and Bette embodied in the old Westport and Stanford era. I've needed to stew endlessly, unbelievably, in my own juice. That sentence says it all, as far as I know.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this reclusiveness, and I'm going to add to the conversation Donald Brown. He's one of our friends from the New Haven Review. He's a writer, critic, and scholar, probably more of a specialist in Pynchon than in Salinger. But for that reason, Donald Brown, I'm going to start with you on this, but I'm interested in hearing from both of you. But Donald Brown, you know, we have these two guys, Salinger and Pynchon, who are celebrated recluses, although in slightly different ways. But in each case, there's almost a little bit of a sense of a cat and mouse game that's going on. You know, that certainly with Pynchon, he's at times kind of laughing at this whole thing that he's doing, where he's not really engaging with people, he's not appearing in public, he's just this kind of guy who's hard to pin down, he could be anywhere. And with Salinger, it's been suggested by other writers that really he does a lot of things that continue to provoke interest in him, that he creates a tension between himself as a recluse and the appetite to know more about him. So, Donald Brown, first of all, what do you make of this whole idea of trying to get away from it all? Or, I mean, is it a real thing or is it a pose?
Well, I don't know. I think the thing that was just read about, the letter from Salinger talking about the tellable life, I mean, that's a great phrase, and I think that's a great idea, and I think it haunts a lot of writers that what makes them tick and what they're looking for, what causes their inspiration, what causes them to work and rework and work on something, isn't something that you can easily explain to someone, even in a well-meaning interview. And the idea that their lives should somehow be able to be summed up, you know, in a biography or a documentary film, it's kind of like against the principle by which a lot of writers and other kinds of artists work and live. And I find it's this kind of, you know, the kind of lurid looking for some little, you know, someone who knew them who has some detail on their lives that's going to paint them in an unpleasant, you know, way is sort of like what journalists are after. And I think writers know that. A lot of them have spent a little time doing some kind of journalism, and they kind of know what dominates that rage to know. And I think they try to elude that if they can. And I think if you get into a position like Pynchon is in or Salinger was in, that you can avoid it, why not avoid it? I mean, there's really no reason to participate unless you really are interested in the press release mentality of your work, and I don't think either one of these men were or are. So that's one thing that I would say about it. And I think the other thing about their writing is that, well, one way in which they're different, I think Pynchon is someone who is more present in a lot of ways than Salinger was throughout most of his life. And I think that's, you know, he clearly is interested in promoting his works. I mean, he's been, you know, in the way that he chooses to do it, not just in the way that, you know, as someone else might demand of him. But I also think it's interesting the point that you raised at the beginning about that kind of idea of identifying with the work. Mm. I think that with Salinger, the thing about Catcher in the Rye is it does seem to cr- create this persona that people identify with, and they want to know the. They sort of feel that they already know. They somehow feel that Salinger and Holden Caulfield are synonymous, and they want to know that person, and they want to, you know, they expect that person to welcome them and want to reach out to them and be their friend. And I don't think Pynchon has quite that kind of. I mean, people identify with him. A lot of writers do. They like the way that he can be so playful and hard to pin down as a writing persona. But they, you know, they recognize themselves in him differently. And I think that's part of what's, you know, different about the two of them in terms of what their audience is looking for from them.
Yeah, I mean, I think thousands and thousands and thousands. We have no idea how many thousands of people have gone, once again thinking they're the only people who do this, gone to Cornish, New Hampshire, and parked their car somewhere and sat around trying to catch a glimpse of Salinger. I mean, just so many people do this. And people I know would tell me about this, and I would always think, you idiots, leave this poor guy alone. He doesn't want you there. But nobody would do that with Pynchon. And Donald Brown, just to pursue that for a second, I think what you're saying, too, is because of the intimacy of the bond that's established between the reader and Salinger and Holden Caulfield, you want more contact. Whereas with Pynchon, kind of part of the fun of Pynchon is not knowing, and knowing that he's kind of laughing up his sleeve.
Well, that's what I think. Like, see, I read him, when I first read him, is sort of like in the 70s, he had disappeared. I mean, after the publication of Gravity's Rainbow, he was gone, and that created this kind of image of, like, well, he's in hiding for some reason, or he's so paranoid that he feels that, you know, the forces of the authorities would be after him in some fashion. It was easy to, like, romanticize him into this kind of figure who's, like, hiding out in Mexico or something. But you know, since, like, the 90s, certainly, or like actually the mid-80s, you know, he's been sort of, you know, his work has been appearing more regularly, you know, he reviews books, and there's a more of a sense of like, okay, he's just somebody who, you know, wants his privacy, doesn't want to be he doesn't want to appear publicly, you know, as himself, you know, and be interviewed and sit on panels and whatnot. But, you know, he's really still living kind of an ordinary writer's life in the sense of his production. And, and one thing I think is interesting about this idea about the five more Salingers is I also don't know, like, I have a feeling that Pynchon's, you know, writing technique is such that it could, I mean, okay, he's still alive, but at whatever point, you know, that his actual life ends, his career might not end, because I imagine he's somebody that has a lot of work that he's concurrently working on, you know, so there might be a lot of things that he never feels are finished, or, I mean, the longer he lives, obviously, the more of those he might finish or get rid of. But
we know that he was talking about the idea for Mason-Dixon circa 1970, and he published it in like 1990 something. Yeah.
And I don't know what these books of Salingers are, but I sort of feel too that sense that, you know, these are writers that if they don't have to put it out, like they're not, you know, there's nobody saying, you know, we need this book from you contractually or whatever, you know, they can sit on it as long as they want and choose what to do with it or not, or it gets left to their estates to deal with. So I think there's a certain similarity there, too. And also the fact that, you know, I think their friendships are important to them, and, you know, the way that their friends try not to, you know, betray them in some sense, is also key to being able to maintain that kind of loyalty with people is important, and it makes you think of the people as, people who are their friends want to support and don't want to, you know, turn against just for the sake of, you know, sensationalism or something.
You know, Will Hockman, back to you for a second. I want to just go back to that whole question of reclusion and being a hermit. And, you know, in the beginning of our conversation, you said, I'm not aware that Salinger ever called himself a recluse, and I'm not sure, you know, how you qualify to be one. Although I think part of that is, you know, it's sort of like Jesse James wouldn't call himself a desperado. I think it's something other people have to call you. But I'm just interested in knowing your sense of, and, you know, as you know, other Salinger biographers have almost argued, well, it was a little bit of a cat and mouse game, and there were things he did occasionally to feed the interest in him. And God knows, you know, looking at the work of Joyce Maynard, who was the torchbearer for this incredibly self-disclosing wave of baby boom writers, the most, you know, the most regurgitating of self or essayist, you know, at her very young age that she could possibly be. Inviting her up to Cornish, New Hampshire just seems like a death wish for a hermit. But do you believe that he had an unalloyed desire for privacy and reclusion, or do you buy the sort of, well, it's a little bit of a cat and mouse game?
Well, first of all, I have to say the Paul Alexander thesis that Salinger was really
a manipulator and boosting sales is probably very wrong, because Kenneth Lewinsky details acts that Salinger did that actually do everything to sink the publicity and slow the book sales down of Catcher. So I don't think he was playing a cat and mouse game so much, or a marketing game. And I do think I like what Donald Brown just said. You know, Salinger's friends were his friends, and he even, Salinger even went to potluck dinners at churches and things like that. So I don't think he was, you know, a hermit looking. There's a famous picture from the New York Post where Salinger has his hand up, almost saying, you know, it's like trying to stop a bullet, only it's a photograph. And, you know, if you saw that photo, you'd say, oh, this is a recluse who can't handle the light like a vampire can't handle the light. But the truth of it is, he was very friendly, and he corresponded to a lot of people for a long time. You know, even the Joyce Maynard stuff, it's not as cut and dried as it sounds. Her mother drove her up to Salinger's. Joyce Maynard was a willing participant, and, in fact, it was a young author really taking advantage of an older author in some ways. And I just have to say, me too. I did a dissertation. I got tenure on Salinger books, and even you, Colin, on this show. You know, we are feeding off Salinger in some way.
Totally.
And a guy, you know, a guy has the right to say, okay, you can take what I put out there, but I'm not giving you the rest.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, we're going to grab a break right here. We're going to come back with more of Thomas Pynchon. If you want to be part of that conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266.
Understand all this fuss about Salinger's testicle. I'm Thomas Pynchon, and I don't have any testicles. You don't hear me whining. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our intern, Garrett Connolly. The part of Bill Curry was played by Herman Melville. On tomorrow's show, Michael Bolton talks about what it's like to be Michael Bolton. And now, back to Colin.
So we're going to finish up this conversation with more focus on Thomas Pynchon, and our conversation is with Donald Brown, a scholar, critic, writer. We know him through the New Haven Review. So Donald Brown, it seems to me one of the differences between being a Salinger freak and a Pynchon freak is obviously the Pynchon freak journey is longer. It spans more years, more material, and it's really this long conversation about modernity and the machine, whatever we decide the capital M machine is, and therefore it is one that can mutate more and more, you know, and you can sort of really kind of stay interested in on his latest sort of take about it. You must be very hungry for this new book, this new book Bleeding Edge, that's coming out later this fall.
Well, I guess so. I mean, one of the things about that is sort of like you could say like the Pynchon freak. I mean, you have to date yourself. It's kind of like with like Bob Dylan, you know. Were you into Dylan before like the withdrawal to Woodstock years, you know, or after? And with Pynchon, you know, you had this sort of thing where up until like 85 when he resurfaced with his collection of short stories, Burner, and then, you know, started to kind of get into a production queue. And before, if you were into him before that time, then yeah, they're similar to the Salinger thing, which he really is this kind of person who's off the map, who's written this really bizarre stuff, and isn't really around and having any kind of tangible presence other than these books, which people pore over and looking for all these clues and what's going on in them. And then he kind of reappears, and it's a different kind of world, and he's writing different kind of fiction in a lot of ways. I mean, it's still recognizably his work, but it's things have changed. The game has changed. So, and from that point of view, I mean, with each new work, a little bit like what we're talking about with the Salinger, where you sort of say, okay, there's this really perfected work that he produced that is the stuff that his name, you know, that sort of, you know, created the name of Salinger. And so, what can we add to that? Do we really need to add to that? And I think with an author like Pynchon, who sort of like has started, you know, and created this, you know, up to gravity's rainbow kind of body of work. And then, okay, what else does he need to do? What else adds to that? So that you get, you know, works which aren't quite as challenging or maybe quite as interesting as some of those earlier works. And so, you know, you start to become your own worst enemy in a sense, I guess, just like with anyone else who just keeps going. So I'm always interested in the fact that he's producing something new and also the fact that he's producing it much more quickly than used to be the case. So you have the feeling, though, still that, you know, he's trying to sort of maintain a certain kind of edge on things. But does he still have it, I guess is what it comes down to.
Yeah, and the Dylan comparison is apt, too, because I think there's also this sense. I mean, like, the new book supposedly has references to Ace Ventura, Ally McBeal, Battlestar Galactica, Beanie Babies, Britney Spears, Geraldo, Pokemon. And he's very much kind of a creature of his moment and maybe even closer to the Don DeLillo we encounter in White Noise. And there's, I think for guys like you, there's sort of a red badge of courage. Like, I read Gravity's Rainbow. It was really hard. There weren't any of these cute little Easter eggs from popular culture, you know, and I guess I'm wondering if you're concerned in a sense that this work won't be difficult and challenging the way that, say, Gravity's Rainbow or V.
Well, see, like the most recent one, Inherent Vices, you know, it wasn't. It was a very, you know, it's Pynchon light, you know, it's sort of almost kind of like a knockoff. Though it has some, I mean, because it's set in 1970, which is a pivotal year for those of us who remember it, right? It was, you know, I enjoyed the fact that he was going back to that time. But there used to be the kind of feeling, even like, you know, sort of the era while people were evaluating Gravity's Rainbow when it was still relatively new. The idea that, you know, he was a great writer of a kind of historical fiction, this kind of fantastic historical fiction, and that when he wrote about the present day or what was near in time, he wasn't as successful. And this was because a lot of people at that time didn't think that much of The Crying of Lot 49, which is now, you know, probably one of the few books that is canonical of his that does appear on, you know, university syllabi and gets assigned to people and they read it. And it's very much of a certain, you know, period of time, like 1964 to 66, say. And because of that, you know, that changed as well. So when he's doing something that's that current, where you've got Britney Spears and you've got you know, the dot-com crisis, then okay, he's clearly like wanting to write something that's very much of the time versus something like Against the Day, which or Mason and Dixon, which are very much like historical fiction. So he kind of seems to want to have it both ways. And one of the things I think happened in my own evaluation was I sort of felt that way when Vineland came out, that it wasn't as deep as Gravity's Rainbow. It wasn't as significant. It wasn't as challenging. It wasn't even as funny. and so, you know, it didn't work. But as time has passed, I see it somewhat differently because the way that it captures that moment, and now we're, you know, it captures the moment like 1984, and the more that recedes in history, the book becomes more important as a you know, gesture towards that time and as a kind of understanding of that time. So, you know, I kind of think it's part of what someone like Pynchon may be doing at this point is just sort of saying, well, if I record, you know, my version of this time that we're all living through, you know, in times to come, this will be looked at differently, and, you know, the scholars of the future will have a different take on this work than we, you know, his contemporaries will have. And I think that's one way to kind of get past the mentality of the dailies, you know, the newspaper critic, you know, who sort of has to read the book quickly, has to make an assessment, has to say yay or nay, and then throw it away, versus, like, the scholars who keep returning to something and trying to figure out how it measures up, you know, long term. So, you know, I think he's kind of having it both ways currently, and, you know, maybe for some time to come.
Yeah. Donald Brown, we got to stop there. I actually was that newspaper critic at one point. I do want to say about Thomas Pynchon two quick things. One of them is, you may remember, he did appear as himself on The Simpsons, voicing his own character in two different episodes, wearing a paper. The character wears a paper bag on his head on screen. Also, when he won the National Book Award, Ralph Ellison thought he was giving the award to Thomas Pynchon. It was actually an absurdist comic named Professor Irwin Corey, who Pynchon had sent in his place. So he does have a sense of humor about all this stuff. All right, we'll be back tomorrow with Michael Bolton. When all I wanna be is just a catcher in the rye.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and when J.D. Salinger died in his home in Cornish, New Hampshire on January 27th, 2010, He was, as usual, unavailable for comment. Too soon?